I'm calling to order the Senate Committee on Consumer Protection and Public Affairs for today, Tuesday, March 10th, 2009. I would like to remind people, I do this occasionally, that our sound equipment is very sensitive to BlackBerry's cell phones and that kind of thing that are turned on. So if you hear interference, it's probably your phone. So if you'd please turn those off, it would be appreciated. So today we're having an informational hearing on the issue of garnishment of exempt funds. We have several people on the list, and when we're at the end of going through the people who are already on, we didn't have an official sign up, but who have expressed an interest, I will ask if anyone else is interested. So please don't worry that you'll be left out. I will call you up if you have an interest. I'm going to start with Jim Corr, Sybil Hebb, and Bob Junedeff, please. Welcome.
Thank you.
Okay. And you don't necessarily have to go in the order in which I called your names. I'll leave it up to you. Go ahead.
Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb for the Oregon Law Center here, and I will go first to provide some introductory descriptions of the issue that we're talking about today and then hand it over to my colleagues here. I want to really thank the committee for taking the time to consider an issue that's incredibly important to the clients of the Oregon Law Center, and that is garnishment of funds that are protected from collection, and I'll explain what that means. You all know that we're in the middle of an economic crisis and that it's gathering steam and snowballing. And as that's happening, we are having clients getting more and more of our clients are unemployed. More and more of them are dependent upon the safety net that the state provides and that the federal government provides to help them continue to meet their basic needs during the time of economic crisis. And the people who have been really the most impacted by this issue are, of course, people with disabilities, elderly people, children, families, veterans, and the unemployed. And so the issue of having unemployment benefits and disability benefits and veterans benefits and the public safety sort of support network undermined is something that is really of critical importance at this point in time for the state. I want to explain a little bit about how exemptions work. Oregon law, as well as federal law, have declared, and this is a long-standing policy, that certain public benefits are exempt from collection. The list is long. The benefits that we feel are the most important and the most crucial to people that we're most concerned about are benefits like veterans benefits and disability benefits and Social Security, the benefits that are designed to meet the needs of really the most vulnerable in our population. So state and federal law determine that because those benefits are so important to people's abilities to meet their basic needs and go about their daily lives, that those benefits should not be subject to collection by debtors. The purpose is not, of course, to encourage inappropriate or ill-advised acquisition of debt, but rather to recognize that vulnerable people need to have some safety net, and that if we put that safety net at risk from collection, then we're undermining the very purpose of the program in the first place. And so it's that issue that brings us here today. What we're seeing in Oregon and what's happened in some other states is that our current garnishment laws, garnishment is a tool by which people enforce collection judgments, those garnishment laws in Oregon are undermining the purpose of the state and federal laws that provide for exemption, and they're undermining the purposes of the public benefits programs in the first place. And the reason is, or the way in which they're undermining those programs and these benefits is that they allow garnishment of funds from bank accounts without notice and without warning immediately, regardless of whether the amounts in the accounts are exempt amounts otherwise determined by state or federal law. And what happens is a garnishment will get served on a bank, and the bank will turn the money over to the court, and the burden then is on the vulnerable person, the person who's the recipient of these benefits, to try to go to court and get that money back. Often they have incurred significant bank fees as a result of the garnishment. They've also incurred frequently bounced check fees because their money was taken away without notice, and they may have written debits on that account prior to the garnishment. And so the impact on the vulnerable person is not only that they're deprived of their money up front, they're also charged significant fees, and the process by which they can seek assistance to get that money back is very complicated and time-consuming. I'll give you a few examples and also draw your attention to an article that was written in the Wall Street Journal in 2007 that contains a number of examples of how this problem has affected people across the country. There are several states that have taken steps to address this issue, and we'd like Oregon eventually to be the session, to be one of those states, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. But I think the basic example that we're talking about is one example that's described in the Wall Street Journal article is Viola Sue Kell, who is 64 years old, a widow, living solely off of Social Security disability benefits of $827 a month. Her account was wiped out completely to the last dollar by a garnishment because of a three-year-old, I believe, hospital bill that was outstanding. She was left without morning any money to pay her mortgage or her electric bills, her food costs, her daily necessities. She was unable to take care of. And so this vulnerable person is in a position then of having zero resources, and with zero resources, the burden is on her to try to go and find a way to assert her protection that exists under federal law as well as state law, that those monies should not have been subject to collection. I have a recent client in our office, or one of our offices, who is an elderly veteran of the Vietnam War. He lost a hand and suffered serious burns over three-quarters of his body, and because of that, he receives veterans disability benefits. That's his sole source of income. His account was garnished the end of January for $2,100 approximately. He is one of the lucky ones. He made it into our office and got some assistance in trying to raise his claim that his money should not have been garnished, because under state, under federal law, those monies are exempt from collection. With our assistance, he was able to fill out the complicated forms and go to court. In that circumstance, he had tried to negotiate with his creditors previously, but it was unable to do that. In that circumstance, the creditor, once we got involved, agreed that they didn't have a claim to the money. They actually tried to help in that circumstance and filed a request to dismiss the case with the court. But the problem was the money had already been taken, paid into court. There were significant procedures that needed to be processed before the court could actually release the money. He's still to date, right now, today, I just called this afternoon to confirm, he still hasn't gotten his money back. So it was the end of January. The claim of exemption at the court process was filed on the 5th of February. And six weeks later, he's without his income. So this is an issue that has a serious impact on people. He was also charged over $200 in bank overdraft fees. We've been trying to negotiate with the bank, and they've agreed to reverse a few of those fees, but not all of them. So it's an issue that will mean that he was without funds for a long period of time, and when he does get his money back, the court said that they hope to issue a check on the 16th or the 17th of this month. If he does get his money back, then he won't get all of it back because the fees will have been deducted. And so our hope is that we can find a way to address that issue and to stop this problem, because there are monies to which we all agree state and federal law prohibits us from turning over for collection, and the process that we have set up in Oregon puts the burden on the person, who's the vulnerable person, to try to get those monies back, and it doesn't work well. We'd like to provide protection up front at the bank account level so that we can ensure that important benefits are protected for vulnerable people and they're not subject to these bounce check fees and deprived of access to their income, and so that also we can avoid the long, drawn-out, and complicated court process down the line. I'll let Jim and Bob tell you more, but I first want to just point out that there are five other states that have taken steps to address this issue. California, New York, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, and Alabama. There are a variety of different methods of trying to address the issue. We think that the most important crucial aspects of protection ought to provide that when a bank has reason to know that direct deposit exempt funds are coming into an account. And generally speaking, these are easy to identify. It's a Social Security check that's coming in regularly in the same amount on a periodic basis. It's clearly identified as coming from the federal government. That's one example. But when those account deposits can be identified, we think that there ought to be some basic minimum level of protection that applies to that account so that the person who has those benefits is assured of some ability to go through their day-to-day lives and meet their needs without needing to seek emergency assistance from local community food banks, et cetera. We think that that puts into place the policy behind these important public benefits, and it also helps us to implement and respect the nature of the exemptions that have been passed under state and federal law. Providing the account protection up front at the bank level helps the beneficiary, the protected, the vulnerable person. We think that it's a reasonable request to make of banks if it's structured appropriately. Most circumstances, they can tell when these accounts contain exempt funds, and all they would need to do is look and see what the level of money in the account is and would be authorized then to return a garnishment if those criteria were met. Also, creditors, we know, and I think everyone in the room agrees, are not entitled to funds that are determined to be exempt. And so to the extent that we're protecting benefits that are exempt, we avoid having the beneficiaries as well as the creditors have to go through the long, drawn-out claim of exemption process, which in the end takes too long for money to come back to beneficiaries, but it doesn't end up in the hands of the creditors anyway. We also think that there needs to be significant protection against bank fees being charged in this circumstance. So that beneficiaries are not made to pay for the fact that their exempt monies have been sought after. I think those are the three major criteria that we're most interested in. We have a bill that we have put forward this session that will propose several aspects. I think we'll defer detailed discussion of the bill to a public hearing on the bill, but for now, in introductory purposes, I think those are the most important issues. I do also want to flag for the committee that there is one that we do intend to work on this, the issues that are outlined in the bill, and that we hope to come back at a public hearing with a good solid presentation about the details. So
thank you, Sybil. And if it's all right with the committee, I'd like to wait until we get everyone's testimony of this panel and then take questions. And I do want to also mention, Sybil mentioned the bill, it's Senate Bill 731. We are not having a public hearing on that bill today. It was not assigned to the committee until after the notice went out. This is an informational hearing. But it is worth noting that some of the provisions in the bill will be a topic of discussion. But this is not a, just to, so the record is clear, this is not a public hearing on Senate Bill 731. Jim?
Thank you. Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, it's my privilege to appear before you today. I'm Jim Kaur. I'm here to provide testimony about the need to make a change in the Oregon garnishment procedure to protect exempt benefits from garnishment when those funds are held in the debtor's bank account. I want to thank you for your time and your consideration of this issue and for this opportunity to be heard. I'm a staff attorney at Lane County Legal Aid and Advocacy Center, and since 1991, I've been an adjunct professor at the University of Oregon School of Law, where I teach and supervise the civil clinic in which third-year law students are certified by the Oregon Supreme Court to handle or to represent legal aid clients under my supervision. I'm not normally involved in the legislative process, but during the past 2 years, we've seen an increasing number of cases in which legal aid clients have had exempt benefits such as Social Security, SSI, and unemployment compensation garnished from their bank accounts by judgment creditors. These benefits and others, such as public assistance, workers' compensation, and veterans' benefits, are exempt from garnishment under state and federal law. And under ORS 18.348, these exempt funds remain exempt when placed in a bank account. That's already Oregon law. However, if a bank or financial institution is served with a writ of garnishment, in order to comply with that writ, they're required to pay any funds in the debtor's account to the creditor, even if those funds are exempt and even if the financial institution knows that those funds are exempt. The debtor must then file a challenge to garnishment to get the benefits back, and that takes often 4 to 6 weeks and sometimes much longer. We had a case last summer in which the debtor did not get the money back for, I think it was 4 to 5 months. So it can be a lengthy process during which the beneficiary of these benefits does not have the use of the benefits, and then, as Ms. Hebb testified, when they do get the benefits back, if they've incurred bank fees, they will incur a garnishment fee, and they may have incurred NSF fees, late charges by landlords, and other costs, so that even once they get the benefits back, they don't get the full use of the benefits. One of the first cases that I saw was a young woman who was totally and permanently disabled as a result of a mental disability. She was receiving a combination of Social Security and SSI, and she worked a few hours each week at a sheltered workshop. Her total income from all sources was around $700 a month. Her account was garnished by a judgment creditor. She had had a bank a credit card, and she had made payments on the account but fell behind. She was sued. She allowed a default judgment, did not contest the case. So judgment was entered for the balance on the account, plus attorney fees and court costs. After the judgment was entered, she offered to pay $50 a month out of her benefits on the account. The creditor refused to accept that and laughed at her over the telephone, then garnished her bank account. They got $369.72, which isn't a lot of money, but it was everything she had at that point. And she filed a challenge to garnishment and sent copies of her bank statements to the creditors. The bank statements showed that her deposits were Social Security and SSI. They were clearly labeled by the bank on her statements. But the creditor still refused to return the money, so she had to wait for a court hearing. At the hearing, the judge ordered the creditor to return the money, and she finally got it back 6 weeks after it was taken from her account. Some garnishments, of course, affect much larger amounts of money. A couple weeks ago, I spoke with a woman who had her account garnished for $3,200 and some. She was on unemployment. She had just received a tax refund. Everything was taken from her account. The challenge to garnishment procedure that is in the existing Oregon garnishment procedure does not adequately protect benefit recipients. First of all, many debtors do not file challenges, even if the garnished funds are exempt. They may not file a challenge because they don't understand how to do so, or they're afraid to go to court, and we're talking about vulnerable populations, or they think it won't do any good because they admit that they owe the debt, or they suffer from mental disability, or they're in a crisis situation because all of their money has been taken from their account, and they can't pay rent, they can't pay utilities, they can't pay for medicine, food, and other necessities. As a result, some creditors are able to keep benefits which have been garnished, even though those benefits are exempt under state and federal law. I've attached copies of the statutory notice of exemptions and challenge to garnishment forms which are provided to the debtor when their account is garnished. These forms, as you can see, are quite complex. I can say from experience that third-year law students have difficulty reading and understanding these forms, and I think it's safe to say that the average debtor likewise finds these forms confusing and difficult to follow. Some creditors may also benefit from the current procedure because taking all of the money from a debtor's account may force a debtor to set up a payment plan with the creditor to get some of their money back and avoid repeated garnishments. About a year ago, I saw an elderly woman appear in court before the judge at an exemption hearing after she had filed a challenge to garnishment. She explained to the judge that that her only income was Social Security, that all of the money in her account was Social Security, and in response, the judge told her to go out in the hallway and set up a payment plan with the creditor. In other words, she was required or forced to use her exempt Social Security money in order to prevent having her bank account garnished again by the creditor. Whenever a bank account containing exempt benefits is garnished, the debtor may incur overdraft charges and NSF fees for bounced checks, as well as late fees and penalties by landlords and other creditors, and these may easily total several hundred dollars. I'm also concerned that a debtor could be evicted for nonpayment of rent or have their utilities shut off before they could recover their funds through the challenge procedure. In addition to these tangible consequences, there's an incalculable psychological cost. When someone's bank account, suddenly without notice, their life savings, their only means of subsistence, is suddenly wiped out. Many beneficiaries of public benefits are among our most vulnerable citizens, and receiving those benefits each month is critical to their survival. As Sybil mentioned, several states have taken action to protect exempt benefits from garnishment from a bank account. Garnishment of public benefits is not a problem. It is a problem not just in Oregon. Last year, the Inspector General for the Social Security Administration reported that during a 12-month period, over $170 million had been garnished from accounts which contained exempt funds. The problem has arisen partly because various state and federal agencies have encouraged and promoted direct deposit of these benefits. Over 80% of Social Security, SSI, and veterans beneficiaries receive their benefits by direct deposit. Both the U.S. House and Senate have held hearings on this issue within the last year or so, but have not taken action. But three states have enacted garnishment legislation and have enacted legislation that protects exempt benefits from garnishment when they're placed in a bank account.
I'm sorry to do this, Jim, but can I get you to summarize the rest of the testimony? I want to have time for questions.
Absolutely.
So
I'm sorry.
We'll read the written testimony.
Okay.
If you could summarize,
okay.
It would be great. Thank you.
Three states have enacted legislation, and two other states have adopted court rules to protect benefits in bank accounts from garnishment. Oregon could take a similar approach by making one simple change in the garnishment procedure, and that would simply be to say that when the bank or the financial institution receives the writ of garnishment, rather than paying the money directly to the creditor, as is now done, the bank could check to see if the funds in the account are direct deposit benefits that are protected under this change, and if so, then a protected amount could be held in the bank account. So, for example, New York holds $2,500 at the bank level. And if there is direct deposit and the account balance is less than $2,500, no money is paid to the creditor. If there is no direct deposit, then the garnishment proceeds just as it does now under existing procedure. If there's direct deposit but the balance is over $2,500, then the difference would be paid to the creditor under the existing garnishment procedure. We live in very frightening economic times, and public benefits are the only means of subsistence for many of our most vulnerable citizens. These benefits are already exempt from garnishment, and we'd like to see a change in the Oregon garnishment procedure to make sure that these debtors retain the use of this money so that they may be used as intended. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Bob?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundeff, and I'm the Director of Disability Rights Oregon. For those of you who aren't familiar with us, we are a nonprofit agency that receives federal money to provide legal advocacy services to people with disabilities across the state of Oregon. I was absolutely delighted when I heard that you were considering or would be considering legislation to deal with this particular issue, and I'd like to just explain very simply why. Most of our clients have a disability. Well, they all have disabilities, but disabilities, of course, come in different brands and stripes. People acquire disabilities at birth, such as mental retardation or autism, epilepsy, other types of developmental disabilities. Some people acquire disabilities when they're in their teens. They may have an auto accident or a skiing accident that results in a spinal cord injury or a traumatic brain injury. The onset of schizophrenia is usually in late teens or early 20s. All during adult life, people, of course, are vulnerable to traumatic injuries, and our seniors, of course, are particularly vulnerable to falls and physical injuries as well as dementia. So all through the course of life, people can acquire disabilities. A person can be working. They can have an income. They can have assets. They can have debts. They could be living a normal life, and bingo, they could end up with an equal opportunity traumatic brain injury or a severe mental illness. And this can render them unable to earn their own income and require them to fall back upon public assistance in some ways, which is why we have a safety net, why we have Social Security and other types of benefits programs. Congress recognized, particularly in the area of Social Security, that people who have worked hard, they've done their part, they've lived life the way that we encourage people to do, which part of that, of course, is acquiring debt, as we're learning more and more about in the radio these days, and all of a sudden they just can't satisfy their creditors. And it's not that they're bad or their creditors are bad, but this is just their situation. And the government has provided them with some money to sustain their lives, minimal amount of money, and they depend upon it. And once their savings are depleted, this is what's left. For years, we've received calls from people with disabilities who, for one reason or another, are subject to garnishment. They may not even know what the word garnishment means, frankly, but they know that the money has disappeared from their account. And they really don't know how to address this, particularly when you're living on the edge, when you're poor, if you have a mental illness, if you have a cognitive disability. A problem like this can be absolutely overwhelming on top of all the other problems you have of poverty and your disorder. And people then will call. Well, actually, what I was noticing and as talking to my staff is that usually people don't call us. Most of the calls that we get are from caseworkers or a family member who they happen to have mentioned, the person has mentioned this to, because having the courage, having the wherewithal to actually call an advocacy organization, let alone have contact with a court, is overwhelming. And what we generally tell them, because as an organization we prioritize our services, as we say, we normally don't handle consumer matters, we'll kick it over to legal aid, so go make that next call. But we can assure you that those funds are protected from garnishment. The federal law says so. But the money's gone. And so they're in this awkward situation. We're in this awkward situation. So explain to them that these are protected monies. Congress recognized that they're protected because you are relying upon them to buy food, to pay your rent, and to take care of the necessities of life. But now you have to go to court and tell somebody about it. And so when the concept of having some sort of protection for a minimal amount of money, basically a unit of funds that are easily identifiable as being public funds up to a certain level of life sustainable level for a short period of time, could be exempt from being inappropriately removed from a bank account, I thought, what a brilliant idea. And that's why I'm thrilled to be here, because I'm very happy to be able to come in and work with you to find a way to make sure that these folks get the protection that everybody wants them to have while assuring the creditors have access to funds that they are entitled to.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Questions? Senator Gerard.
Thank you, Chair. I have two. This would probably be for Sybil, and they're really fairly short questions, but we've been talking that we're only going to do direct deposits. So my understanding is if they came in with a check and deposited it by mail, that would not be included in the bill.
You should ask a question.
Chair Bonamici, Senator Girard, that's correct under the concept that we have proposed, and I the reason that we've proposed it that way is that it's we think it's easier for banks to identify and to implement that.
Okay.
Clearly, there may be other sources of funds that might be exempt that would end up in an account,
okay.
But we think it's hard to find a way to get at that.
Follow-up, Chair?
Please.
Okay, the second question I would have, and this one, the examples that you give are kind of cut and dry. The money is Social Security or exempted funds, or they're not. What happens when you mix the two? Say that you had $1,500 of Social Security, $1,500 of a small pension, in which that one would be subject to the garnishment. The account has $2,500. How do you propose to take care of that situation?
Chair Bonamici, Senator Girard, that's a great question. And we find, I think there's sort of two parts to the answer. And one is that, as Jim and I think Bob both mentioned, the vast majority of cases that we see, they're sort of the only source of money. It's very rare that there's additional money. But we know that happens. And there are accounts where there is money, that some of which may be exempt and some of which may not. And that's why we think the best possible answer to the question is to find some minimum level of money that is exempt from garnishment in an account, and below that, whenever there's direct deposit exempt funds into that account, that amount of money is determined to be safe from garnishment. Now, in some circumstances, that might mean that the protection would then extend to some dollars that might not be otherwise determined to be exempt. And that would be a policy commit choice that we would be asking the committee to make, to say these are people who are vulnerable, they're relying on important public benefits programs to meet their basic needs, and so we will make sure that we're not taking money out of their accounts to leave them with zero. And the reason that it's important to pick a number, at some point it becomes a number that may not may provide more protection for some or much less protection that would be necessary for others, but in terms of administration and implementation, what it does is it makes sure that there is a basic level of money in an account to meet basic needs, and then above that amount, then the current claim of exemption process that Oregon has is sufficient to suss out which is exempt and which is not exempt. And there are procedures that the courts use to determine, when there have been commingled funds, how to sort that out.
One last question. You feel that I was reading through the California cases in Alabama where they have fixed amounts. Would it be possible to have an amount that would be, say, 1 month's worth of SSI or something to that effect instead?
That's a great question, Chair Bonamici and Senator Girard. We think that the most workable approach is to have a set amount, because then banks don't have to go through too much individual determination. I know this isn't a public hearing on the bill, but the amount that's proposed in the bill that we'll be looking at is $2,500. The reason we picked that number is that the maximum Social Security monthly check is $2,400. Other states have picked other levels, as Jim described, and that's a policy choice that we would be asking the committee to make.
I wanted to ask a question following up on Senator Girard's question. If somebody received, say, $2,600 per month, but the next didn't spend all that and had an additional $200 the following month and got the other $2,600, would everything above the $2,500 be garnishable, meaning the converse of Senator Girard's example, that while there may be some instances where non-exempt funds are garnishable, there would be some instances where exempt funds are garnishable?
Chair Bonamici, yes, that is the case. If there was more money in the account than if the money in the account was exempt, but it was above the amount that we determined to be the minimum level of automatic protection, then those dollars could be garnished at the bank account level. The claim of exemption process that currently exists, though, would be available for the beneficiary to go, but we feel that's less pressing because at least we've preserved some basic minimum level to let you buy the gas to get to the courthouse.
Understood. Other questions?
Senator. Under current law right now, if you're, as I understand what you're saying, when a financial institution gets a request for a garnishment, they can be looking at an account that they can easily say is completely exempt funds, but they have to deliver those funds even though they know that's a violation of the law?
Chair Bonamici, Senator George, yes, essentially, is the answer. And we hope that this will take banks out of that bind. Our state, you know, the garnishment requires them to turn money over right now under Oregon law. State and federal law says that the monies are exempt from collection. And there have actually been lawsuits in other states sort of alleging that banks ought to have known and therefore ought not to have turned the money over. We're not interested in going in that direction. We'd like to find a way to get banks out of that dilemma and also, I mean, our goal is to preserve money for the intended recipients. So, I don't know.
Thank you very much. Senator Rosenthal.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to clarify one thing. So, when this money is garnished that's supposed to be exempt, do these forms go to the lending institution, I mean the bank, or is it actually the creditor that you have to go to get this money back?
If I may, Chair Bonamici, Senator Rosenbaum, I'll defer that question to Jim since he knows more about the process.
Chair Bonamici, Senator Rosenbaum, when the money is garnished, the bank pays the money. Under Oregon procedure, the bank pays the money directly to the creditor, and then the debtor can file a challenge to garnishment. The court notifies the creditor that a challenge has been filed and directs the creditor to turn the money to the court, and then the court holds the money until the challenge hearing. One problem with that process is that the courts take about 2 weeks, 10 days to 2 weeks after the hearing to actually issue the checks to get the money back in the situation that Sybil's client has.
So, just to follow up, and maybe I think you did probably answer this in response to Senator George, but so there's basically no procedure in Oregon right now to protect these funds. I mean, even if banks wanted to work with their depositor, they don't really have the ability to. I mean, they're just sort of the intermediary, it sounds like.
Senator Bonamici, Chair Bonamici, Senator Rosenbaum, that's correct. I know there's one credit union in Eugene that if they see that all the funds in the account are direct deposit, Social Security, the head of the credit union calls the creditor and suggests maybe they would withdraw the writ of garnishment. But beyond that, unless the creditor agrees to that, the bank's caught in a bind. The writ of garnishment requires them to pay the money to the creditor.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. We'll take as you step down. I just want to note that if the courts are closing one day a week, it might take even longer. sorry to say. And next we have General Caldwell. And is Mr. Evans coming with you?
Yep.
Terrific. And Paul Evans.
That's the problem.
Yeah.
That was.
Welcome.
I see they're marching out there to let the political prisoners loose, so
at the right place. It's been noted.
Thank you. Noted that the political prisoners will be released right after this hearing, correct?
Are they Republicans?
Do our best, General.
Yeah, please do. For the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Military Department and was asked today to come by and give some thoughts on this particular subject that you're talking about. And I think that as being my job and 9 to 5, like all bureaucrats, besides that, I had the pleasure of serving on the Governor's Task Force for Veterans Issues during the interim. And to my left is Major Paul Evans, who doubles as the Governor's Policy Advisor for Veterans and Military Affairs Business. So I've asked Paul to step in as well, because we had an awful good opportunity during the summer, spring and summer, to travel the state of Oregon, go to numerous places, and talk to veterans about particular issues. Garnishment is an issue with veterans. It doesn't happen all that often, but when it does, it's usually, as was indicated in your previous panel, it's usually the most vulnerable, the least able to negotiate the system, and have the least assets or resources to go out and find representation to help them get through a fairly complex system that they're very unfamiliar with. One of the other great lessons that we've learned through this process was that, and even being in the system as I am, and 38 years in the system, I can tell you that I was astonished to learn in the last several years that a 100% disabled veteran receives less than $3,000 a month. That would be, I always thought as a young soldier going through the system that if you reached a certain rank and you were getting X amount of dollars and you were 100% disabled because of a service-related injury, that you would get 100% of what you were getting while you were on active duty or serving, and that's just simply not the case. And so you end up with, of course, you get the veterans' medical benefits, which are good, and they're getting better. But if you're in the right area of the state, and if you're not, then they're a little more difficult to find and negotiate. But unbeknownst to me was that I've known several veterans through this process that I've met that they live a very, very meager life based on that, and they are unable to work. They simply cannot work. There's nothing that they could possibly do, and all in the service of their country. When something like a garnishment, you know, takes place, then that just puts them further in the hole that they're already in. And I think that anything we can do to make that process less onerous and make that make a system that the veterans and other people in those same categories can at least survive, then I think it helps us all. In many cases, we've had veterans come to us, and I know that Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs does a marvelous job with respect to taking care of veterans, but we have very meager funds, relief funds, to help these people out. Many of the service organizations end up stepping up, and they do a wonderful job of helping these people out when they do run into those rough patches, and they do. They're like every other American, and they simply just don't have the resources to take care of that. So I would encourage you to do whatever you can in your deliberations to come up with a system that's at least equitable with respect to keeping these people from having to not have heat in their house or not be able to do the things that we pretty much think are normal for American life. I'll tell one little story. There was a good friend of my mother's and father's. My father passed away some time ago, but my mother was the chauffeur for these folks to go to church every Sunday, and she showed up one Sunday, and their house was just incredibly cold, and she asked them if their furnace was out. Did something happen to your furnace? And they said, well, no, not really, but the wife said, Paul's medications are so expensive these days that we just simply can't run the furnace every day. We just can't do it. We've got other issues. We've got to pay our bills, and it's just too cold. And this is LeGrand. That's where I'm from. It gets a little cold over there in the wintertime. And she said, well, Paul, you're a veteran. Why aren't you seeking veterans help? And he said, no, that's not for me. I served my time in World War II. I did what I was supposed to do, but I didn't get hurt, and I didn't have any injuries, and I'm supposed to take care of myself. And so my mother called me and said, would you please call him? And I know him. I've known him all my life. And I called him and explained to him that, you know, you paid your time, you did your job, you did what the country asked, and there's benefits there for you. And he said, well, yeah, but I haven't needed him till now. And I said, well, you need him now. And I set him up with an appointment in Walla Walla. My mother actually took him over, got him set up. Suddenly, from about a $700-$800 a month medical bill that he was paying for medication, he went down to where there was $10 every 3 months to mail that stuff to him, and he was able to put heat back in his house. So I think sometimes and I got to tell you, he had a successful life. He was not somebody that just barely got along all his life. He raised a good family, lived in a fairly meager house. I even told him that, you know, there are provisions that you don't have to pay your taxes, your land taxes, if you can get deferrals. He said, oh, God, I'd never do that. And I said, Paul, your kids are almost 60 years old. They don't need the money. And he wouldn't do that. He said, I got an obligation. I'm going to pay it. And that's, you know, and there's a lot of, most of them are that way. So when they get into a tough spot, I think it was just doesn't seem fair to put them in even a deeper spot and put them in a deeper hole when they run into these particular situations. So I would encourage you to, you know, go forth and see if you can't make those people, even if they're non-veterans, if they're in those situations, they still have the same needs, and make it so they can live at least. And then we can let them sort out their other problems with the help that is out there, whether it be, in our case, veteran service groups, or in other cases with nonprofits that you just heard. So be happy to answer any questions that you may have, and it's a pleasure to be in front of you today. I don't normally get in a committee like this. So.
Thank you, General. I appreciate your testimony. And Mr. Evans, do you have something to add? Thank you.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Evans. I'm policy advisor to Governor Kulongoski for Veteran Services and Military issues. I also had the pleasure of serving as the chair of the Veterans Services Task Force. Hadn't really planned on being here today, but when I was asked by General Caldwell about this specific issue, there are some relevant points that I'd like to emphasize and try to be quick and be done and kind of let you get on with your work. First, I'm concerned about the veterans currently experiencing the garnishment. I'm actually, quite frankly, much more concerned about the veterans we're producing right now and the impact of the garnishment upon the veterans in about 2 to 3 years. And the reason I emphasize that is that we are at a unique moment in history. We are at the edge of watching a major transition in Iraq and most likely in Afghanistan in the next 3 to 4 years. And we're not going to have a much different military than what we have right now, which means we're going to be asking the same folks to continue to go, and we're going to be putting the same burden on the same 2% of Americans that have actually had any direct role in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I want to emphasize that figure again, 2%. World War II, 90% of the families had some direct connection. Vietnam, the issue of the number was closer to 30 to 40%, depending on how you want to measure it. 30 to 40% of the families had someone that was serving. In this particular conflict, it's been 2%. That's how we got to multiple tours. That's how we got to changing tours. That's how we've put the pressures that you're all aware of on the Guard and the Reserve, unlike any time since the Civil War, at least. My concern, looking at the task force recommendations and the discussions, is that once a person falls behind and gets into a cycle of not able to keep up with their responsibilities, which is easier and easier in today's economy, then other issues become even larger. It's also important to recognize that the Veterans Benefit Administration, until very recently, under the past administration, was purposefully designed, or at least purposefully directed, to disallow as much benefits as possible. That doesn't make them bad people. That just makes the fact that they didn't have the money that they needed for all the folks. So they try to disallow as much as they could so that the benefits that are often awarded to veterans for their disabilities, after review, are often recognized for being a little less than they probably should have been. That's one of the big reviews that's going on right now with the change in administration. We also know that among 18 to 34-year-olds, the suicide rate among veterans is 2 times the national average. And I suspect that over the next 2 to 4 years, we're going to see that statistic continue to climb as veterans come back and try to make sense of what happened as we lose Iraq, and they try to make sense of 4.5 years of their life invested in a failure. These are very important issues. And while I don't believe this affects a lot of the veterans, it certainly does have a major impact on those that it does affect. And anything that we can do to try to build as much breathing space as possible for folks to get back into a normal, quote-unquote, at least as much of a normal life as they can get back into, whether they're Guard, Reserve, former active duty, or what have you, I think is an important step. So from my perspective, I think this is a good thing to do, and I'd certainly try to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much. Any questions for the panel? No. I want to thank you for your testimony and for your service.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. Next, we have Pam Levitt and Janet Jocelyn. I hope I said your name right. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. I'm Pam Levitt with the Credit Union Association of Oregon. We represent 83 state and federally chartered not-for-profit cooperative credit unions in Oregon. We want to thank Senator Bonamici for calling together a group of people interested in this issue and having a work group meeting prior to this hearing. We're certainly sympathetic to the impact on consumers when money in their account has been forwarded in response to a writ of garnishment. We're in very challenging economic times, and Oregon credit unions are working very hard every day with consumers to assist in refinancing home loans, paying off debt, budgeting, and financial education. We do have some concerns about the, I know we're not talking about the proposed Senate Bill 731, but that is the language that we had to look at. So Janet Jocelyn in our office will go through some of those issues.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Bonamici, members of the committee. Pam had asked me, Janet Jocelyn. I'm with Pam at the Credit Union Association of Oregon. And I'm here to help address some of the more operational issues that our credit unions would be looking at and open those up for consideration as the process moves along. The credit unions could be in a position of actually responding to a garnishment as a garnishee. We could also be in a position of a judgment creditor. So we kind of are sitting on both sides of the table. There are some issues, as Pam mentioned, that we would like to bring to your attention. One of those being the current verbiage reasonably identify. That it needs to be a little more broadly defined. How, to what extent are we to reasonably identify these funds? And the reason for that is to help to limit our liability and to define how to what extent we go to identify these funds as being exempt is important because we need to know what the measurement is to protect ourselves from liability from both the creditor in that maybe we didn't go far enough and as far as our member, the debtor, in that maybe we went too far. So we're looking for some protections moving forward cover that instance. There's been a lot of talk about identifying funds in the account as exempt. In some cases, yes, it is certainly fairly easy to look at the account records and look at the originator of the particular ACH deposit and determine that it's SSI. In many cases, it may not be. So is that enough that we have done a reasonable amount of due diligence to determine whether there's exempt money or not? We don't know in some cases what the payment is for. It may come from Treasury. It may come from a state agency, but we don't know the purpose of those funds. There is also discussion about the amount of time that it would take to do any kind of a look back 45 days to determine the amount of money in the account, to determine the deposits, what those deposits made up, look at the commingling of deposits. If that currently under the law, we have 7 days to respond to a garnishment. Typically, we respond right away because we do have just the ability to garnish what is there and respond with that. However, looking at the process that's going to be required to determine some of these reasonably identifiable deposits, it may take some time. And I would see that the credit union would have to place some kind of an administrative hold on that deposit at the time they receive a garnishment. And whether that would take 24 hours, whether that would take 2 or 3 days of that 7-day process, that is still going to leave the member with the inability to reach those funds should they need it. So it's not completely eliminating that particular member, consumer, being able to access their funds. Again, just some brief comments, and we appreciate the ability to work with you as you move through the process. And the credit unions are certainly willing to comply with the law regarding garnishments, and that's our intent. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I wanted to ask a question about something that was raised in the earlier testimony about occasionally, and I think it was a credit union in Eugene that was mentioned, occasionally if the credit union understands that the funds are exempt funds, they may call the creditor and suggest that the creditor withdraw the garnishment. Is that something that you've heard of? That
well, credit unions are very resourceful, that's for sure. And while we do perhaps see that happening, there are some creditors that, under the law, currently that's not required. And there may be some creditors that may not appreciate the context that they're getting that phone call. So our advice to our credit unions is to comply with the law and respond as required with the funds in the account.
Understood. Question to this panel? Senator Girard.
I have a technical question, and that there's a term that I'm not familiar with, and that is wild card exemptions. Could you, do you know what that refers to?
Chair Bonamici, Senator Girard, I am certainly not the person to address the wild card exemption. Perhaps someone from another at another time could address that, but okay. At this point I couldn't speak to that.
Yes, and Senator Girard, I'm sure we'll be getting to that when we have a hearing on the bill.
Well, I'd like to know the term.
I just want to remind you this is not a hearing on the bill.
I understand that. I just, I kind of... I think the problem has been well demonstrated, and so I'm kind of trying to form in my own mind what kind of solution I would come up with. Is there anything that, why can't we just check a thing or check a box when you set up the account that says, are you is the primary part of your deposits going to be Social Security, SSI, veterans benefits, whatever, and not have to go through kind of some of the stuff here? It seems that that would be a lot more upfront for you.
Senator Bonamici, Senator Girard, I just think it's quite difficult to be able, for the financial institutions, specifically credit unions, to some of our smaller members, to just be able to determine when you're looking at an account. I mean, I think if you set up a checkoff system, when you look at the account, you're looking at a sheet that doesn't tell you, where those, accounts mostly from.
Follow up, please. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about a new account.
No.
So, I mean, like when you set up a new account, that's just a question when you set up the account. And so, that would be real upfront for you. I mean, this account is a Social Security account. That's primary means of deposit, whatever. It just seems like it might be an easier solution than the one that's being presented.
Senator Bonamici, Senator Girard, we did discuss in kind of this work group discussion about the concept of setting up two accounts, and that's certainly an option that was on the table and that we were open to, but I think that there are some issues from a consumer perspective, too, about setting up dual accounts.
I just say it would be a new account. It wouldn't have to be a dual account.
Other questions? Things to ponder. Well, thank you very much for your testimony. Next, we'll have a panel, Jim Marquis, John McHenry, and can I have Ken Sherman come up with you since we have three chairs and three people? That'd be great. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think Mr. Sherman is being rounded up.
He's here. He's on his way.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Marquis on behalf of the Oregon Collectors Association. I have with me a member of our association, John McHenry, who owns a collection agency in Milwaukee. I thought it might be appropriate to hear from somebody who actually goes through this on a daily basis. I just want to say that and starting out, and I'm not going to address Senate Bill 731 since the chair has been clear that it's a moving target. Nobody in my association, that I am aware of at least, intentionally garnishes exempt funds. Nobody likes to do it. Nobody likes to go through a claim of exemption and go to a hearing and all of those sorts of things that occur. Generally speaking, however, a creditor embarks upon garnishment of a bank account or these kinds of accounts at financial institutions as a last resort. It's usually when you can't make contact with the debtor, the debtor won't talk to you, the debtor refuses to talk to you, or the debtor just tells you, don't call me anymore. They're left with no alternative but to garnish these funds. Usually they have no idea what kind of funds are in the account. They just know there's an account. And under present law, the debtor then has the right to file a claim of exemption and get their money back. We had a long discussion about this subject, as I shared with the chair earlier today, in our government relations committee last week. And one, the members of my committee said that when they get a claim of exemption, they try to contact the debtor if they can get a hold of the debtor, they tell the debtor to come in with some kind of proof that the funds are exempt, i.e. here it's Social Security or whatever, and they release the garnishment and give the funds back. So that's not at all unusual with my clients. I think I don't represent all creditors. I represent a small number of creditors, so I don't know what goes on in the rest of the world. I will say that in talking with our members and with John that hearings are set very quickly in these matters, usually within a week. The delay seems to come after the hearing in the courts getting the, because under the present law, we have to submit the, if it goes to a hearing, we have to submit the money is, if we have to give the money back, we have to submit that to the court. And it's the court that takes 3 or 4 or 5 weeks to get the money back to the debtor. And the committee may want to look at that and see if you can speed that up a little bit in where there is a claim of exemption, because whatever you do here isn't going to result in no more garnishments. So there always will be some need for claims of exemption, and you need to speed that process up wherever you can. And if that's the courts, then we need to talk to them about that. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions when after the panel's done, and I'd like to turn it over to Mr. McHenry.
Thank you so much. Mr. McHenry.
Good afternoon. My name is John McHenry. I'd like to thank the committee for having me here. I own and operate a small collection agency in the state of Oregon, Milwaukee, Oregon. Almost all the collection agencies in the state of Oregon would be considered a small business. In getting a call from Jim about this bill, I just went back and did some research, and less than 1% of our garnishments have a claim of exemption filed on them. And those aren't all bank exemptions. There's all different kinds of exemptions, which has been stated here today, that can be made on the funds that are garnished, whether it's wage or properties or bank funds. And I can assure the committee that everyone in my industry that I know of knows what funds are exempt. And if there's a consumer that comes forward or we contact that says that these funds are indeed exempt, it's a fairly painless process. You know, I think the hardest thing for them probably is getting us the bank records to identify that the funds are exempt. And if they're exempt, then we would release, well, at that point, if it's a bank garnishment, we don't have to release it. We just submit the funds back to them. Have a claim of exemption. I got a call on Friday from the court saying a claim had been filed. I didn't even have the paperwork of the claim. Have a hearing next Tuesday, and I haven't even got the funds from the bank. And that's how quickly these matters, the court is addressing these matters, and it's fairly rapid. I mean, the court called me to make sure that I had time on my calendar to come out to Washington County and appear for the claim exemption. At that point in time, there was an effort made to try and contact the consumer. A lot of times consumers don't readily contact us. We've gone through the process of getting a judgment against the creditor and or against the consumer and that whole process. So a lot of times there's not a whole lot of communication. But if we can get the debtor to communicate at the point the exemption's filed and the funds are exempt, we would have no problem sending them back their monies.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, before I turn it over to the Oregon Bankers Association Learned Council, because I know I'll never get the mic back once I do that, I just want to say, if there's a way that we can work with the committee on this matter so that truly exempt funds are never sent, that's fine. And I think I've discussed some ideas with Sybil and with Madam Chair where there's a recurring automatic deposit. We think it would be fine if that amount were exempt. We're just held by the bank, and I think the bank can readily identify that, and Mr. Sherman can speak to that. The the problem with the approach that Legal Aid wants to take in terms of just saying, well, the first 2,500, no matter what, is exempt, is that, and I think Senator Girard hit the nail on the head, the problem is always commingled funds. And while we want exempt funds to be exempt, we don't want creditors to lose their rights to collect money legally due them from non-exempt funds, and therein lies the problem when funds are commingled. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Sherman.
Thank you. Mr. Sherman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Ken Sherman. I'm counsel for the Oregon Bankers Association, and I'm happy to be here this afternoon. I wish this were happening tomorrow afternoon, because tomorrow we're having a meeting of the what they call the Oregon Bankers Association Bank Operations Committee. And that is a committee made up of people who do all of the technical stuff inside the bank, and one of the important things they do is process garnishments. And those people are the walking, talking experts on how it really works and what they can do and what they can't do. I'm guessing that as you look at this concept, you have some questions about what can banks really do, and I think I heard some of that from the podium earlier, and I think this time tomorrow I'll have a better idea. I've worked with them for 30 years on garnishment questions, but they always educate me a little bit more every time I meet with them. So my guess is that we can find a solution here, and I think that a problem has been recognized, and particularly in these difficult times, we need to be responsive to that problem. So we're prepared to do that and to be a constructive part of the process as you search for a solution for this. But I do think it will be very much to our benefit if we can have the input of these operations people who process these things and know what they're capable of doing in terms of gathering information and discerning what is an exempt dollar from a non-exempt dollar and that sort of thing. Beyond that, I guess I'd just say that I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. I'm glad we gave you a topic of discussion for the meeting tomorrow, and look forward to hearing back from you on that issue.
Thank you.
Committee members, yes, Senator Girard.
The question is for Jim. You were bringing up the commingled funds. Under current law, how do you discern that now?
When you go to a claim of exemption hearing, there's requested bank records brought in, and then 99% of the time, all the parties look at the bank records, and if there's any undocumented deposits, cash, checks that aren't, because every time there's a Social Security check deposited, 99% of the time it's notated right there on the account. Unless they bring with them like the stub of the Social Security check to prove that those funds were Social Security funds, or under testimony in front of the judge, then you know anything other than that is considered commingled funds.
I wanted to follow up on that. For Mr. Markey and Mr. McHenry, you mentioned that I think you said 1% of your cases have a claim of exemption filed. And during the earlier testimony from the Legal Aid and Oregon Law Center and Oregon Disability Center, it seems to me, and even from General Caldwell and Mr. Evans, it seems to me that a lot of the people who are involved in this issue are not people who can get themselves out, find somebody to help them, get them through or even to that claim of exemption process. So I guess I wanted you to address that a little bit and maybe acknowledge that there may be other people who actually have exempt funds that have been garnished but can't, for whatever reason, get up to the process where that determination can be made that there were commingled funds, or even get there at all.
Madam Chair, Jim Markey again, respond to that. I think you're right. I think there are people who have a problem in terms of filing a claim of exemption. And then there's a whole other category of people who are engaged in conflict avoidance. The kind of debtor that you wind up garnishing is the debtor who won't talk to you. And even when you get a claim of exemption, sometimes, and try to call the debtor, I heard this from some of my members, you try to contact the debtor, and the debtor sees it's the collection agency on the caller ID, and they won't answer, you know, I mean, they just won't respond. So so there's that as well. And I mean, I think there's a whole gambit of reasons that that happens. So,
I also have some input on that. As a business, as running a business as a collection agency, you have to make determinations on ability to pay. And if somebody's on disability, we're not going to file legal action. I mean, there's just, I mean, we know those funds are exempt. And at that point in time, we have certain statuses for our clients to indicate to that party that we've investigated the account, and we consider that party ability to pay to be substandard. And, you know, at that point, the determination for the client is whether or not they're going to write off the debt. It's not for me as a business owner to go and put more funds into the account to pay filing fees, pay my process server, pay my staff to look for funds that ultimately aren't available. It's just not a good business decision.
It seems to me that that's even more of a reason to figure out a way to prevent this from happening. Senator George, and then Senator Gerard has another question, too.
Oh, but go ahead. I yield.
I guess this is one of those situations where perhaps there could be a difference between our in-state guys and our out-of-state guys. And, I mean, you could have some out-of-state guys that basically file these things knowing that there could be some problems. I mean, I'm guessing, and since I don't want to regulate people differently, I'm guessing the problem is probably less with our in-state guys who can, you can actually get into court that day, than it is out-of-state collectors. Am I correct?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator George, we've discussed this issue thoroughly in this committee, I think, and we all know that of the 800 or so complaints a year, 90% of them are on out-of-state collection agencies, and some are probably in this area. And, yeah, I mean, that's where we see the problems. Yes.
Senator Gerard.
Thank you, Chair. I don't want to beat a dead horse, but I really need some answers here, and that is, let me give you an example. If you had $1,500 of Social Security, that would be exempt, and you had $1,500 of pension, that wasn't exempt. In mid-month, say the balance is $2,000, how much of that would you be able to garnish?
$500.
$500? Okay.
The exempt money is exempt. I mean, if they have...
But it's exempt through the whole cycle?
Yeah, if they have 3 months worth of Social Security in the bank and haven't touched it, and it's just for the fact of numbers, $1,000, and we garnish it, that money's all exempt.
Okay.
Can I follow up on that?
Please do.
So let's work through that. Let's say, for instance, I have $1,000 that comes in every month from Social Security and $1,000 that comes in from a non-exempt fund, and my expenses, so I get $2,000 of income a month, and my expenses are $1,000 a month. So at the end of 3 months, I have $3,000 in my account. How much of that can you garnish?
Well, therein lies the problem with getting a stringent set of criteria is going to eliminate the due process that the courts are afforded to for a judge to determine what he thinks is the right amount to be garnishable. And that's, you know, when I go to court on a bank claim, I'd say at least 50% of the time when there's Social Security involved, specifically Social Security funds involved, there are commingled funds. And meaning that party is willing, able, and working. Early 70s, late 60s, you know, part-time job or something like that, and there are funds that are commingled, and that's where the judge makes his determination, and we defer to the courts at that process, and you know, the judges render good decisions in those when that's the case.
But Madam Chair and Senator George, there's no statutory scheme here. This is a judge applying the best judgment he can in all of these cases.
Are there questions? Thank you very much for your testimony.
You.
Is there anyone else here who is interested in testifying on the issue of garnishment of exempt funds? If not, I will... Oh, Keith Carnes, come on up.
Thank you, Senator Bonamici, for having me. Just wanted to make a couple quick points. My name is Keith Carnes, of course. I'm a consumer law attorney here in Oregon. I'm also admitted in Washington. And one of the things I think the committee may need to consider is that while many states, well, only a few states have a bill similar to what's being discussed here, there are many states like Washington where anyone who issues a garnishment has an affirmative duty to sign an affidavit that the money that they're trying to garnish is not exempt. And so in Washington, an attorney or the court or the small claims creditor or whoever has to sign an affidavit saying, I want to garnish this money, and I have reason to believe that that money is not exempt, which is far more onerous, if you, from my understanding, for those who issue garnishments. As part of my practice, I offer pro bono for anyone who asks an affidavit that I've created for them to sign and give to any of their creditors that say, my only source of income is Social Security, and I'm exempt from execution as I understand it, and I provide it to anybody, and they pass it on. Several of those people have come back to me after passing it on and said, I'm still getting garnished. You know, people are still garnishing after I give them that. What can I do? And I've brought several claims in federal court for violating fair debt collection laws for those who are being garnished after they give documentation showing that they're exempt. I was at a meeting of other consumer attorneys, and I mentioned this. And they all, to a person, said, is it this one attorney out of Eugene? I said, how did you know? They all have the same problem with the same people doing it over and over again. And it is a real problem. I think we can all agree to that. But I think that what legal aid is proposing is far less onerous than what other states are requiring, which is having them go out before they issue a garnishment and see if it's exempt or not. And secondly, I guess to answer one of the questions that I heard about, you know, if some of it's pension and some of it's Social Security, the answer is pensions are exempt for the most part as well. Wages are exempt up to 75%. And so it's very hard to find people who don't have exempt funds, whether they're commingled with some portion that's not exempt. You know, usually the only non-exempt funds that I used to find these people having are lottery winnings and gifts. Everything else is just about exempt. And so it's not, is this money exempt or not? The question is, you know, is there a bright line we can draw so that we can protect them for something and then fight over the rest of the money in court and let the judges do that? Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Keith. Any questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, so Keith, that does raise a question because it did occur to me that if it's illegal to garnish these funds, there ought to be some obligation on the creditor to know that. And the earlier witnesses were telling us that they basically, if they know funds are off limits, they won't garnish them. So in your experience, these states that do have an affirmative duty on the creditor to sign something, is that pretty effective in keeping them from taking action in these cases?
I find that it's far more effective. That you see far fewer garnishments in Washington. You know, we have a very big bankruptcy presence there. Whenever there's garnishments of exempt funds, they all come to my desk, whether they're from Seattle or Tri-Cities or Medford or wherever. There's far less of it happening in Washington than there is in Oregon, absolutely.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Last call? Okay, I'm going to close the informational hearing and adjourn our committee for today. Thank you.
Very interesting.
Interesting problem.